the just people, the righteous people who helped persecuted people, who helped the persecuted Jews and Roma, but also even in Rwanda. So in all the genocide situations, you have a handful of people who do help. So why do they do this? And how the children have the strength to fight? And one of the answers I found was to say no, to not accept what you are told, but think by yourself. You know, not going with the stream because those in power or those older or those with money or those with prestige. No, that's one of the keys of both survival and also being courageous or a rebel, saying no to the mainstream and starting to look for an alternative, for a different solution.
This is the podcast to restore your faith in humanity. In this podcast, we are interviewing men and women whom we call Chilean giraffes, courageous, tireless workers for the greater good. May each of them inspire you to follow in their tracks and contribute your own part to a just society and a healthy environment. Welcome to another episode of the podcast to restore your faith in humanity. Today we welcome Judith Kiss, who is an economist, a political commentator on Eastern Europe, and a writer of both fiction and non-fiction. She is the former consultant to the UN World Institute for Development and Economic Research. Judith Kiss is Hungarian by birth and lives in Geneva. I recently had a long talk with her about her autobiographic novel, The Summer My Father Died. But today I want to talk with her about war, about resilience, and about the necessity to believe in humanity. Three of her books guarantee that we will have a fascinating talk today. Firstly, Arms Industry Transformation and Integration is a comparative analysis of the post-Cold War experience of six Central European countries. The second book, far less academic, though certainly as factual, is More Nights Than Days. This book gives a voice to child genocide survivors of different ethnic background. Then, three, is the most poetic of these three books, a book called La Lessive, or The Laundry, 15 short stories based on the real life of migrant women who arrived at Geneva, driven away from their homes by wars and persecution. Welcome to our podcast, Judith. How are you today?
Thank you. I am fine, thank you.
Are you in Geneva or in Budapest now?
Yeah, I am in Geneva, and in Geneva it's grey and cold and... yeah, but I saw a little piece of blue this morning, so...
That's more than we have. Here it's only grey.
Yeah. Is it raining? No.
The sun may still come. So I'm currently reading this beautiful book here, La Lessive, which I find absolutely beautiful, Judith.
Thank you.
So it's the story of 15 migrant women. And despite the traumas that marked the paths of these migrant women, thanks to their courage and resilience, they managed to overcome their difficulties and reconstruct their life. That resilience, Judith, is omnipresent in your work, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, I realized that not while doing these books, but actually I realized that that's a point that in a way links them all. Yeah.
Even the book about the arms industry in the former Central European republics talks of a transition from war industry to a peaceful industry. Also, that is resilience, no?
Exactly. So that's what I was looking for in all those works, at how you get out of a crisis situation towards something positive and constructive. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not the main trajectory that these companies chose, but I found some examples and I was always very happy to find those. Mm-hmm.
As we speak, I think you have heard the news. As we speak, a rebel army has taken control over the whole of Syria. So what seemed impossible for decades has now happened in less than a week. They have overthrown the government of al-Assad and the al-Assad family, which has been into power for decades there. So these rebels, they talk of moderation and respect for ethnic and religious differences. And commentators all over the world, they express hope, even though these rebels have an extremist background. Yet, Judith, on all the images that I saw this morning, I saw almost no women on the streets. Am I too cynical? Should I be more tolerant for this male dominance?
Well, we will see. But I think, yeah, there is a lot of caution, Rand, because this is, as you say, this is a very double-edged situation, because when the Syrian uprising began, it was beautiful. It was a real democratic mass movement, very inclusive, inclusive of all communities, women, lots of women were very active. And it was a citizens uprising, very articulate, very, very beautiful. And then it was crushed, and the West has a huge responsibility in that they just abandoned the Syrians. And so Assad with Russia and Iran could keep power. And of course, there is a certain vacuum that this group now, apparently with a quite active assistance from Turkey, managed to fill. So we don't know, because, as you say, the movement doesn't have a very glorious history. So we see if there are real changes or not. But I think women are very cautious to go out to the streets now. Yeah.
I had a good glance at your book, More Nights Than Days, which talks, is actually the, it's a lot of biographies of people who have survived genocide as a child that you have gathered. And in your preface of this book, you say, and I quote, "It seems that everything has already been said about the Holocaust, but that not everything has been heard. Immediately after the war, there was a wave of publications by Holocaust survivors, including some children, followed by decades of relative silence. Most of these works were simply forgotten." Now, how can we explain this, that, you know, after a war, there was a tremendous urge and necessity to talk about what happened, and then suddenly that everything went into this public amnesia, like we went from, wir haben es nicht gewusst, from jetzt wissen wir es, aber wir vergessen es?
Yeah, there were decades. Of course, I mean, this was such a huge drama, and there was also a lot of shared responsibility also on the side of the Allies. So nobody was very keen on talking about it, and the survivors were traumatized so very, very deeply. So it was difficult. There was, as you say, there was a first wave of writing, but after that it just went into silence, and it took a lot of time and lots of efforts for these people to start to speak again and start to write again. So that's there is this tendency to sweep everything under the carpet instead of looking at it, facing it, and then saying, okay, how could this happen? So, and that's the big tragedy, and that's why actually that was one of the main purposes I wrote this book, because I said, okay, there was this Holocaust, which was absolutely terrible, but it didn't end, because a couple of decades later, another Holocaust took place, then another, so you go to Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, the Rohingya, so...
Was it important for you to put these genocides next to the Holocaust?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because, I mean, of course the Holocaust was unique, but these other Holocausts are also unique. So these are other genocides which are unique but have lots of common features. So that's what I wanted to show, that there are mechanisms you can recognize in all of them, however different the background and the actual situation of a country is, or what is the community that is targeted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You in the beginning, you were not keen of reading any Holocaust books at all, were you?
No, because I read some growing up, and it's such a terrible subject, so you don't feel like going into it. And certainly, okay, so I read, of course, the basic works, watched the basic movies and all that, but it was a subject I never ever wanted to work on. So it was like really I got into it almost against my will. But then I just felt, okay, I absolutely have to do this.
Yeah, you read more than 100 biographies of horrific stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, how didn't that make you very depressive?
Well, it was very difficult, and it really took a long time to write that book. It was 9 years altogether to make it into a book. And yeah, it was very, very difficult. But on the one hand, I really felt once I started that I really have to do this, because it's so important as a warning, as a lesson that we should really listen to. And on the other hand, there is so much beauty and life in these books, actually. So that's the other thing. And of course, I put the emphasis on that. So this this book is not about suffering. It's about fighting against suffering, and that was very important for me.
Yeah. I want to venture a little bit into this process of storytelling of one generation to the other, because all of that starts with the silence, because a lot of these survivors were at first not keen at all to say anything. And in your book, in the preface, you talk about Boris Cyrulnik, the famous French neuropsychiatrist, who was himself the only survivor of of the Nazi persecution in France of his family. And he says, and I quote him, "Trauma does not only affect the traumatized person. Those around him and their children, they suffer the consequences. This transition occurs through contact, through the way they speak or remain silent. After the war, these people have often experienced great social success, but regularly accompanied by intimate difficulties that they transmitted to their children," end of quote. Now, Judith, I know that you yourself are the child of Jewish parents who barely survived the Nazi persecution. Is Boris Cyrulnik right? Are you a traumatized person because of what happened, not to you, but to your parents?
Well, Cyrulnik is right, and he also knows, I mean, he worked with lots of people with this experience, and he himself, he wrote the first personal book about his own story after 40 years of writing other books. So that's also very telling. And yes, I experienced this when I was growing up in my family, this silence and sort of lots of hidden traumas and hidden pain and loss, and which was sort of part of my baggage. And then at one point I started to work around that. I wanted to understand what is that. So, and I think the fact of working on that, trying to understand, helped a lot to overcome it. And actually, it's also, I say that in that other book, but I think that in a way more and more that because it was a hidden story, so I didn't grow up with stories of persecution and personally, of course, other stories of persecution were very present because it was a very, very political family. But with this burden of being condemned and of survivor's guilt and all of that, so because that was hidden, I could actually be much more cheerful than many other children in my generation who grew up with these stories, you know, in other families where they spoke about it.
So you actually were a little bit blessed by the silence of your parents?
In a way, yes. But this is something I was incredibly angry about it for quite a long time. And I also thought it was very sort of almost irresponsible on their side because they made us very vulnerable. But really looking back, and this is just the last couple of years, that I say, actually, it had some advantages.
Because in La Lessive, there is this, after each chapter, there is the voice of the child asking questions. So it's clear that somebody's telling these stories to the next generation.
Yeah.
And so you put focus on it.
Oh, yes, very much. And actually, I mean, in the Lessive, so that's, these are stories of people I know. About half of them are my close friends, and these are their personal stories. And the other half I got to know through doing this work. And most of them never told their story, or many of them didn't tell to their children their story. And when I, at one point, when I decided, okay, I am going actually to write this, they all said, oh, but nothing happened to me, so I am not interesting at all. Why would you write about me? So it was really amazing, this process, how they started to talk, and then how, so in the process of writing, how they reacted once they read, so each of them read their story, and the story got its final form only when they agreed, so when they said, okay, this corresponds to me, and then this is fine. So it was a process of really, for themselves, make feeling that actually they are important and their story is important and they, it's worthwhile to tell. And after the book came out, it was very beautiful because we had one event in a theater where some parts were read from each story. And in this event, there were only the women and their families and friends. So there was no public. And so it was like a big family coming together. And many of the children who came felt, wow, that's my mother and that's my story, that's my family. So it was really, really beautiful. Yeah, so it's very important to tell these stories.
I switched to More Nights Than Days, in which you quote Annick Kayitesi Yozan, who says, I accept that Mama will never have a tomb, and I understand that I will never be in peace. I have to become her grave as long as her bones are scattered somewhere on these hills. When she was alive, she carried me in her womb. Dead, I'll carry her around in my womb, on my back, everywhere, always. This is the transmission of the story, which is so essential, and it has to happen in what Boris Cyrulnik calls the hyper memory, that you do do something artistic with it.
Yeah, and actually it's very beautiful what she writes, and it's very pertinent for many of this, you know, in already the Holocaust survivors, but also the survivors of other genocides. So there is this feeling that, okay, nothing is left. I mean, in Rwanda, in many cases, yet they don't find the bodies, in Bosnia either. So the way she says, and there are other writers who say the same thing, that my book is your tomb, my words, you know, I bury you there and I carry you on. So it's a very beautiful gesture. But and coming back actually to the silence, the Rwandan survivors or the Cambodian ones, they also needed, and the Bosnians as well. So these authors I deal with in this book, they needed decades to be able to start talking about it also. But then it's very impressive the way they start to do it, yeah.
Let's switch to the book that you, this more, let's say, a more dull book, academic, your book about the arms industry in the former Soviet-influenced, let's call them by name, like Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania. The war industry, people say that there is no peace without arms. I mean, I hear it more and more often. Albert Camus, he once said, peace is the only battle worth waging. So he turns it around. And what do you believe? Is it possible to have peace without armament?
Yes. I know today it sounds completely absurd, but you know what I try to show in all those books I wrote about arms industry, and also in a paper I'm working on now, is that the nature of this arms production is such that it produces wars. You know, it's a kind of production that needs outlets. To put it very simply, outlets, you have to show your product, and you show your product in, you know, there are arms fairs, but then they don't function. But in the war, they do function. In coming back to Syria, when the Russians entered to come to help Assad in the Syrian to crush the Syrian uprising, they brought all their new arsenal, you know, to show all these new weapons. So this is what we produced, you know, and there was a live demonstration. So, and the same thing is happening in the Ukraine. Yeah. So that's, it has a really this infernal logic, this type of production.
I read a newspaper. The newspaper I read is called The Standard. It's one of the main Flemish newspapers. And this weekend, there was an article about eccentric tech entrepreneurs in the Silicon Valley in California. And these entrepreneurs have been developing toys and fast cars and spacecraft and such. But they are now venturing into making war drones. We're talking about guys wearing flip-flops, Bermuda shirts, Hawaii shirts, and they are often close friends also of the next vice president, J.D. Vance. So they are venturing into this war economy. They speak of the Oppenheimer moment. Also, when science was lured into war making. So, you know the Bob Dylan song "Masters of War," where he despises the people who make weapons, who make arms. Have you ever met in your life and in your professional life, where you probably had to meet people who make arms? Have you ever met people making wars that you really were sympathetic with?
You know, the difficult thing with this research I have been doing for decades, going to these companies, talking to the people, because that's the type of research I did. So I went to the ministries, I went to the research institutes also, but for me the most important was to go to the companies and see how they function, see the people who work there, talk to the directors, to the developers, and if they let me, to the workers. And so one of the genuine difficulty was that most of these people have this split conscience. For them, it's a product like anything else. On top of it, this production makes leave a whole town, or, you know, this used to be huge enterprises. So you had very often company towns where the company that was dual purpose, both military and civilian, they produced heating, and they had all these social institutions and crèches and infrastructure and everything. So people kept saying, well, we make the city live, so why should we stop this? On top of it, producing a tank is 30 times more profitable than a tractor. So we make people live better. So it's like a completely distorted logic. And most often people didn't ask the question, well, what exactly are we doing? So in my long career, I dared to ask this question very rarely, and normally just after an interview that lasted 5 hours late to the night, and I said, well, what do you think about it? How do you feel about it? I mean, normally I didn't ask these questions.
So there was this split And after several hours, you dare to break the wall or to peep into it and to ask about the moral implications.
Exactly. So it was, and in a couple. So I remember there was one CEO of a big company who I thought he was going to cry because he said. Because that was during the Yugoslav wars. And he said, you know that thing that made, I don't know if you remember, there was one attack on the market of Sarajevo. When, you know, Sarajevo was besieged, and there were, you know, it was surrounded and they were shooting on the city constantly. And so there was a market, and then in the middle of the market, they bombed it with rocket launchers, and the guy said, you know, we produced that arm, and I saw what it does because it was on TV. So this guy, I think the first, it was an engineer. I think the first time in his life, he really looked into what this meant, and so there were a couple of answers like that, but most often people were just in the split conscious and never came up. So it's really amazing. And of course, everybody would say this kind of thing. Yeah, we need arms to be safe, and we need arms to make the country live and all that. Yeah.
Now, Warsaw recently ordered almost 100 Apache attack helicopters for the Polish armed forces. Earlier, they decided to purchase 400 American HIMARS missile systems and 1,000 South Korean tanks. The Baltic states also, they want to increase the recommended defense expenditure for all NATO member states to 2.5% of national income. Are we witnessing the reverse evolution today, and how hopeful are you that we can stop that?
Oh yes, we are witnessing an arms race all over the world. So this book, actually, there is a previous book before that talks about how these countries, which were part of the Eastern Bloc, where their defense production was part of the Warsaw Pact production system, how after the political changes in the late 80s, early 90s, how they come out of there. And, you know, they go through a huge crisis. And then for a couple of years in the late 80s, early 90s, there is a window of opportunity for change, for conversion into peaceful production. And that is possible because there is political will to do that. So all these countries say, okay, now Cold War ended, so we don't need this anymore. We don't need this building up weapons production and arms and arsenals and armies. So in those really very few years, there is an amazing effervescence of alternatives. You know, what I just said before, this to transform these company towns, preserving the production base but gearing it towards something else. There is the possibility because there is political will and there are incentives and there is money to do that. You know, to create different regional development patterns, different job opportunities, to look at every aspect of the production system. So those were really very productive years. And then slowly, from the mid-90s, it sat down because everybody said, okay, well, it is more lucrative to produce tanks. And mostly because the political establishment backed that. Because at that point, you know, there was the question of joining NATO or European Union, and NATO came first. So, you know, all these countries joined NATO first and just after that European Union. So the whole military thinking and considerations came to the forefront again. So we have a historical example that this is possible if there is political will. That's the basic thing. And then you can transform this economy because even, I mean, research very clearly shows that all this investment that goes to producing arms could be much better used producing other stuff, you know, and not to mention that arms production and wars are incredibly destructive for the environment, you know. So even in those early 90s, there were a couple of companies that instead of, you know, military systems started to work on early warning systems to prevent or alert natural catastrophes. What happens if there is a tsunami or an earthquake, or what happens, you know, if there is a drought or, you know, so things, very useful things that we could absolutely use today. So what I'm saying now, we are in the middle of a completely insane arms race. And I don't know, if the world survives, then there should be a complete change of
Are you hopeful for that?
Oof. I have to be hopeful. That's
yeah. It's like Albert Camus says: there is a duty. There is a duty to say yes, even when everything inside you says no.
Completely right. I completely agree. Exactly. So we can just hope that that there are other social forces that will, you know, counter these trends.
Talking of Albert Camus, I recently had a podcast talk with Dilip Simeon, who is a friend of yours. Mm-hmm. Did you hear it?
No.
It was no problem. But we talked about, of course, of Mahatma Gandhi, and mm-hmm. and also about Camus, and Gandhi and Camus, they share this strictly non-violent and anti-authoritarian approach. Dilip Simon is especially fond of the book The Rebel of Camus, in which Camus says that there is a duty. First, there is a duty to say no to every social mm-hmm. system that claims it has all the answers to all the problems. There is not even the totalitarian regime, but the mere idea that the government has all the solutions, you have to resist that. That's something for Camus to rebel against. But for Camus, he says that every no that you put, he says, should have this little yes of something else, something unknown, something creative. Judith, are you a rebel?
Yeah, in that sense, absolutely. Yes, yes. And actually, this is very nice. Yes, Camus was a really great thinker, apart from a really good writer. This no, coming back to the book about child survivors, one of the, you know, when I looked at what helped them to survive, what helped the children to survive, and what was the motive for people to help them, because there were also the just people, the righteous people who helped persecuted people, who helped the persecuted Jews and Roma, but also even in Rwanda, in all the genocide situations, you have a handful of people who do help. So why do they do this? And how the children have the strength to fight? And one of the answers I found was to say no, to not accept what you are told, but think by yourself. You know, not going with the stream because those in power or those older or those with money or those with prestige. No. You have to ask. You have to ask, what is it? Why is it? How it works? So very often, that's one of the keys of both survival and also being courageous or a rebel, saying no to the mainstream and starting to look for an alternative, for a different solution. Yeah, so that's a key point.
You did many, many decades ago, you carried out research on questions of economic and social development in Latin America, in Mexico mm-hmm. especially, I think. Mm-hmm. No?
Yeah.
Were you hopeful in those days that Mexico would become like a social paradise, an economic paradise?
Well, it's actually very interesting because when I went to work on Mexico, I was mostly interested at the beginning on economic history. You know, the question for me was, how is it possible that all these countries in Latin America that are incredibly rich and they are blessed by nature and everything, why are they poor and why they have all these problems and why they have all these military dictatorships? So that was the question for me. And so I was first, you know, into economic history. And then, of course, you find colonization that completely distorted development and plundered these countries. So, and then you find capitalism that continued the same thing, you know, exploiting, making them really satellite-dependent structures. So that's what I found. And then I was working on 20th century Mexican development. And to my big surprise, I found quite a few parallels between Hungary and Mexico, so between the Eastern European patterns and that type of Mexican development. And the interesting thing was that in the early 20th century, there was, and then after the war, there were periods when, you know, they tried to find an alternative to this kind of capitalist, dependent capitalist, extractive economy. And then, of course, the domination swept it away. So that was very interesting. So by the time I was there, I didn't think at all that was going to a kind of alternative social type of more distributive, more just society. Of course, I couldn't. I at that time I didn't suspect that it would become what is it now.
Because now, if you look at Mexico, well, I don't know if you can call it a narco state, but the narcotic industries, let's call it the gangs, are in all segments of society and in all provinces of Mexico. So that's That's not warfare as such. It's not producing arms, but it's producing something very disruptive as well.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, in a way, I would even draw parallels between arms and the drugs, because both are, you know, on the surface, they are produced as any other product. You know, that's what, you see, and then they get into the circulation of, you know, producing surplus and buying this and that and investing here. So it has a sort of similar patterns, and it's terribly destructive for both for the producer and the consumer societies. So it's really very, very sad. You can't call it a warfare, but there are hundreds of thousands of people who are killed in this process.
Have you returned to Latin America lately?
No.
Would you?
Yeah, I really feel like.
Are you a traveler at all? You like to travel?
Not so much now, but actually I do love to travel. But now I have a different lifestyle, but I love to travel. And I should go back there, because I have many friends who are very dear to me.
Now, the world today, one more question. I don't know if we can... Because we are talking about hope, about restoring faith in humanity, about the possibility that there is good in every bad, that there is hope in every despair. When you look at the... we have talked about Syria and the changes there, even though we don't know if it's going to be hopeful or not, but at least it's a change. In the West Bank and in Gaza, there is a change going on as well. It's more of the same. Do you agree with me that it's more of the oppression that has been going on for already 60 years in that region?
It's much worse. It's much worse. It's this complete destruction. I mean, what happens in Gaza, it's just ethnic cleansing, extermination, total destruction of the Gaza Strip. And it goes systematically to the West Bank as well. So what they do, pushing out the Palestinian farmers and oppressing and attacking, it's terrible. So it's much, much worse than you know, oppression as business as usual. Yeah.
Being a Jew yourself, are you not afraid to be called a traitor by your Jewish friends and relatives? Because if you look at Germany, for instance, in the past year, more than 800 cases of censorship have been reported to silence people who only talk about the need for a ceasefire. So there seems to be a clear strategy of the Israeli government to silence, to put pressure on other countries to adopt a zero tolerance on all criticism of Zionism. So how do you feel? Do you feel this pressure from friends and relatives?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, I mean, this is the policy. You can't criticize, you can't express your views, even if you're an expert, which I am not. But so it's a real censorship. In Israel as well, so people even get into jail for protesting or writing against. It's like in Russia, writing, you know, calling what happens in Ukraine a war. People can get into jail. So it is really terrible, and it's very frightening. And what happens in Germany is completely absurd. it's surrealistic. And on a personal level, yes, I mean, I have very dear friends to whom I don't talk because, or they don't talk to me because we disagree on this issue. So I can't, I can't accept the argument that they are defending themselves. I mean, this is not for me, it's completely not this is what's happening. So it's very painful and very difficult, yeah. And personally, I feel terrible about it, exactly, also because I grew up with this story and because I have... The book about the child survivors came out a couple of weeks before the 7th of October. So, and my big naive hope was, okay, this book, you have, I mean, it's like a warning that this shouldn't take place anymore. And it's...
Is that book still in print? More Nights Than Days?
Yeah. No, it's quite recent, so like I say, it's around, and it's because it's available on open access, so it can actually circulate, which is very good.
And this one, La Lessive, will it be translated into English or other languages?
Well, I would really love that because I mean, as you can see, this is a very nice human stories and that tell a lot, you know, it also talks about changing the perspectives, you know, of, because there is also, if we are talking about brainwashing, you know, the migrant crisis and the migrant who is the danger and who is the enemy. I mean, this is also a completely artificially fed phenomenon. And I mean, but I went with this book, just look at the person, look who is she, and in this case, and this, who are these women? They are exactly like you and me. They want the same things, they have the same feelings, just they are human beings. They are not a problem or a crisis or a conflict. So it would be very nice to have it translated in other languages. That for German, for example, you know, where, I mean, now in all European countries, there is this complete, you know, making migrants the scapegoat for society's ills, and all these extreme right parties ride on this wave, which is completely nauseous and destructive and untrue on top of it. So it would be very useful to have it, translated.
Well, I really want to thank you, Judith, for offering your dear Sunday morning to our podcast. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Dimi, also offering your precious Sunday morning.
Well, anyway, for those who listen to the podcast, I hope you have enjoyed this talk, and be on the lookout for the next podcast to restore your faith in humanity.
While you're waiting for the next episode of our podcast, why don't you check our website, fondation-ghf.one. You will find a lot of information, interesting thoughts, and fascinating stories there.